Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everyone. Good afternoon, and welcome to our Blog Talk Radio show, brought to you by Columbia and Weill Cornell Center for Eating Disorders. My name is Barbara Smolik, and I'm part of the administrative team at the center. And I will act as your moderator today. We're broadcasting live from Washington Heights in New York City. This is the last in our series that we've presented in honor of Eating Disorders Awareness Week. We're excited to have two experts with us today, Dr. Laurel Mayer and Dr. Robin Sisco, who will be speaking about obesity. We will take some questions from our callers when we are finished. Before we begin, I'd like to cover a few housekeeping tips. Anyone can join this talk by either dialing 347-996-5875 or by going to blogtalkradio.com/Columbia Psychiatry NYSPI. If you have a question for the speakers, just press 1 to speak to our host at any time, or send a question through Twitter by mentioning the handle at Columbia Psych. And with that, Dr. Mayer and Dr. Sisco, we're excited to have you with us today. Would you please introduce yourselves, and then we'd love to hear a little bit about today's topic.
So I'm Dr. Laurel Mayer, one of the psychiatrists here at the Columbia Center for Eating Disorders, and with me today is
Robin Sisco. I'm a psychologist at the Columbia Center for Eating Disorders, and we're going to be covering topics related to obesity. So rates of obesity and overweight have reached epidemic proportions in the United States. According to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, more than a third of U.S. adults and children are currently overweight or obese. Obesity is associated with a number of medical conditions, including heart disease, stroke, type 2 diabetes, and certain types of cancer, which are some of the leading causes of preventable death. Overweight and obesity are determined by a person's body mass index, which is a combination of your height and weight. Body mass indices over 25 are considered to be overweight, and more than 30 are considered to be obese. If you're not sure what your body mass index is, there's a number of online tools, including one from the CDC, that are available if you're interested in calculating it. You can just look for it on Google. It's particularly concerning that childhood obesity has more than doubled in children and tripled in adolescents in the last 30 years. Although the most recent studies, both in adolescents and adults, suggest that these rates are stabilizing, it does appear that those who are already overweight or obese are continuing to gain weight, suggesting that they're at risk for developing obesity-related complications. For younger individuals, this is a particular concern because we're not sure what will happen for those people who've had long-term obesity-related medical issues.
The estimated annual medical cost of obesity in the United States was $147 billion if we're using 2008 U.S. dollars, clearly higher today. And the medical costs for people who are obese are greater than those who are normal weight by as much as $1,400. Given this significant burden on individuals and on our economy, it's worth thinking about how obesity develops and what causes might be modifiable. We have come a long way from thinking that overweight and obesity results from a lack of willpower. People just aren't strong enough to control what they eat. But there are also genetic factors and the toxic food environment that are commonly associated with the changes in the rates of overweight and obesity over time.
When we talk about the toxic food environment, what we're referring to is the fact that our modern food environment supports overconsumption. Portion sizes have increased dramatically in the past 50 years, and people prepare fewer meals at home. Fast food is commonly available, it's inexpensive, and it tastes good. Unfortunately, it also has a lot of calories and fat. In many neighborhoods, it's also cheaper to purchase unhealthy foods like chips and soda than fresh fruits and vegetables.
Now, we also know that there is definitely a genetic component to body weight, but there's no single gene that's yet been found that determines what our weight is going to be, and it's very likely that it's going to be a combination of multiple genes that contribute to one's weight. One of the genes that we're looking at is called the FTO gene. FTO gene appears to be associated with a risk of developing increased weight, a risk for weight gain in adulthood. And even before we can see increases in weight in adults, studies have identified that people with more copies of this FTO gene show different patterns of eating, including eating more high-calorie foods and more energy-dense foods. And this can be seen in kids as young as 4 years old with this particular variant of this gene. And our clinic is trying to study this gene and its effect on eating patterns and related brain activity in healthy kids between the ages of 5 and 10 to try to better understand the relationships among these factors. Now, despite all of our best research efforts, no one has yet been able to disprove the first law of thermodynamics for all of you physics fans out there. And so basically, we maintain our weight when the calories we take in are the same as the calories that we burn off. Calories in have to equal calories out to maintain weight. So therefore, to lose weight, the calories you take in have to be less than the calories you burn off. And that leaves us with diet, or our calories in, and exercise, the primary form of our calories out, as the main treatment targets for overweight and obesity.
I'm sure our listeners are familiar with many diets that are out there. There are too many to list here. There are probably more coming every day. Unfortunately, none have definitively been proven to be more successful than another. But in general, diets that promote a healthy lifestyle change or modest changes that help to promote better eating are more successful than extreme diets. Successful weight loss and maintenance is really a lifelong process, and many diets include components that are very difficult to maintain over the long term. Some people are interested in learning more about low-carbohydrate diets and whether these diets increase metabolism.
So another pilot study, actually, that our group is participating in, and it's a multi-site, actually, pilot study, is trying to better understand whether the low-carb diets, something like the Atkins diet, for example, leads to increases in metabolism. Do you somehow burn more calories when on that diet compared to some of the other diets? That's an open question. Nobody knows, but we're trying to do the research to figure out if there are differences in diets.
And when you're talking about diet interventions for children, it's especially important to remember that children are living with the rest of their family. And it's important to think about family interventions that will help to change the food environment at home to promote successful weight loss and to provide options that are available to children who don't have control over their own food choices. There's also physical activity interventions, which is if the diets address intake or the calories that you're taking in as that part of the calories in versus calories out equation that affects body weight, then exercise affects the calories out part of the equation. For children and adolescents, there may actually be more options available to increase physical activity because children are often expected to be active during recess or gym class, other activities at school, but there's often also organized sports and other activities that could provide exercise. Finding opportunities for exercise can be more difficult among adults, but it's certainly no less valuable.
And in addition to these diet and lifestyle and exercise interventions, there are some medications that have been useful. There's no magic pill yet that just makes the pounds come off without having to do anything else, but there are a number of medications on the market that can be helpful and might be considered in discussion and consultation with your doctor. One of the most commonly known ones is actually a medication not on the market anymore called sibutramine, which promoted significant weight loss but also has some significant side effects. And medications, even when they're helpful, all come with side effects that have to be considered before you incorporate them into your weight loss regimen. Medications currently available are Orlistat, which is known as Xenical, also sold over-the-counter known as Ally. And this mechanism of action is basically a fat blocker. It tries to inhibit the digestion of fat from your diet. Its side effects because of this lack of digestion of fat are sometimes unpleasant for people, but it is available and it is reasonably safe and actually approved for kids over the age of 12. There are newer medications to the market, one called lorcaserin, which is known as Belvique, which acts on some chemicals in the brain called serotonin to help make us feel more full and less hungry. And again, if we're less hungry and we eat less, that's one of the ways in which we lose weight. There's another new medication, which is really a combination of two medications that have been on the market for some time. The new medication is called Qsymi. That's its trade name, and it's a combination of phentermine, which has been a weight loss appetite suppressant medication on the market since 1959, and topiramate. Topiramate is actually a medicine usually used to control seizures, but also has a side effect of weight loss. And these two medications, phentermine and topiramate, when used in combination, do seem to promote weight loss. But again, they also have side effects that have to be taken into account.
Given all the challenges associated with weight loss, diets, exercise, medications, and maintaining weight loss, it may not seem worth all the effort. But even modest weight losses of 5 to 10% of body weight, or 30 pounds for a person who is 300 pounds, can have a significant health benefit. And even when it's difficult, it is possible to lose and maintain weight. We generally know from the National Weight Control Registry, a study of individuals who've been able to successfully lose and keep weight off, that typically keeping weight off requires things like eating regular meals, including breakfast.
Your doctor was right. Eating breakfast is a very important meal of the day.
Engaging in regular physical activity, which can be things like taking the stairs, parking your car a little bit further away, and eating a more limited variety of foods. Once a person has gotten to a more extreme form of obesity, the treatment options tend to be a little bit more limited, and doctors often think about weight loss surgery options. In general, clinical practice guidelines suggest that people who have a body mass index of 40 or greater without any medical problems, or those who have a body mass index of 35 or more with comorbidities like type 2 diabetes, hypertension, hyperlipidemia, or obstructive sleep apnea can have a surgical procedure. Actually, in the most recent version of these guidelines, patients with diabetes or metabolic syndrome and a body mass index that's lower of 30 to 34.9 can be offered a bariatric procedure, although the evidence for how that procedure will work in those patients is more limited.
So basically, surgery isn't something that we undergo lightly. It's really a procedure to think long and hard about, but the complications of obesity and having obesity and diabetes or obesity and high blood pressure make us think about surgery a little bit sooner than we otherwise would have. That's the shifting down to including people who have BMIs of 30 as possible surgical candidates.
And it's also true that people who have those lower BMIs and diabetes or metabolic syndrome often see a reversing of type 2 diabetes, which is an important outcome of the surgery, which is one of the reasons why it's considered. In general, there are three types of weight loss surgeries, what's called gastric bypass, gastric sleeve resection, and laparoscopic adjustable gastric banding. All three of the procedures work by physically limiting your stomach and gastrointestinal tract to try and absorb foods and nutrients in a different way. Gastric bypass is the most extreme. Gastric bypass and gastric sleeve resection both require permanent changes to the gastrointestinal tract, whereas adjustable gastric banding is the least extreme, and it is reversible. All of these surgeries have complications, and those are balanced by some of the outcomes related to the surgeries. In particular, people seem to have good weight losses. An amount of weight that you could lose would be greater than what you could lose through going on a diet or exercising. Unfortunately, some people do require revisional procedures. What that means is sometimes you'll have one procedure done, like a laparoscopic adjustable gastric band, and you're not losing enough weight, or you have complications and you need to have a different type of procedure done. And those are occurring more and more commonly now. In general, psychological symptoms seem to improve, but there are concerns about those people who experience ongoing problems. So there's no evidence to suggest that people who experience binge eating episodes before surgery have any differential outcomes after a weight loss surgery. But if people start to experience binge eating episodes again, after they've already had surgery, that can be a negative prognostic indicator. There's also some movement to perform surgeries among younger individuals who are extremely overweight. These are typically older adolescents, usually between the ages of 14 and 18. There's limited long-term data on the outcome of these patients, but we are at Columbia doing a number of studies looking at the psychological outcomes of these adolescents who receive surgery when they're younger. And in general, they also seem to experience notable improvements in weight and psychological health.
People are starting to think about trying to treat obesity and prevent further weight gain in younger and younger kids because of the medical complications and the lifestyle implications that exist. And while a number of years ago, I don't think anyone would have thought that surgery as a weight loss management tool was something that was going to be promoted for kids and adolescents, there's certainly a lot of research being done to evaluate the safety and the efficacy, right? How well do these procedures work if we're going to be asking our teenagers to undergo these, what could be considered for them, radical procedures that require a lot of lifetime behavioral control.
And all of the treatment options we've discussed, both the diet, the exercise, the medications, and the surgeries are not magic. Surgery also requires a lot of changes to diet and physical activity to receive the most benefits from the procedures and to ensure fewer complications post-surgery. And I think that that also brings us back to thinking about prevention efforts such that we don't have as many kids who are ending up in need of obesity interventions in the future.
You know, Dr. Sisco, you mentioned prevention efforts, and there recently was that report, I think as recent as yesterday, that maybe the rates of prevalence of obesity in kids has actually gone down for the first time in many years. And I wonder what you think about the prevention efforts and the intervention efforts that have been taking place and whether that's contributed to some of the finding that was recently reported.
Yeah, the study that was published yesterday was really interesting because it showed a decrease in the rates of obesity among very young children between the ages of 2 and 5, although the other age groups in the sample, including older children, adolescents, and adults, didn't show much movement. So it's possible that the efforts that are being made through, the Let's Move campaign or other types of prevention efforts, getting word out about the different types of food choices and activities that should be engaged in with preschool children is helping. But there's also a question of how sustainable these changes are and whether, in fact, they are, true changes, because with a lot of these large-scale studies, we really need to see data over time before we can conclude what's working and what's not working.
So I think it sounds like we really need to continue on these prevention efforts and the education efforts and all the efforts, especially that New York City is making in trying to promote healthy eating and increased availability of fresh fruits and healthy foods and vegetables in terms of farmers markets, or increased availability in bodegas to try to make healthy foods more available to everybody who needs them, and the efforts to get people more active, the City Bike program, and trying to get people more active and have biking and other physical activities easily accessible, and the campaign in New York City to put a park within no more than 10 minutes of every New York City ICE. All can contribute to our efforts towards controlling obesity and making people more aware. There are new nutritional guidelines that are about to come out with making calories on labels more prominent, again, I think as a way to increase education and awareness. And one of the bigger changes is going to be making the serving size on the nutrition label more consistent with what people actually eat, so that it's not that you see a bottle of Snapple and think, oh, that's one serving, when actually if you read the label closely, it's really two, but that the calories and nutrition label will really more reflect what you're actually likely to eat rather than what some ideal serving size might have been at some previous era that we have moved far away from.
I think if nothing else, the study from yesterday suggests that we're doing well with keeping things where they are, and now we need to start thinking about how to roll back the rates that we're already seeing in our country and make things a little bit better in terms of overweight and obesity across the population.
Well, thank you so much, Dr. Mayer and Dr. Sisco, for that great overview on obesity. And we have a few questions that have come in from our callers we'd like to share with you.
Great.
One caller asks that her daughter's pediatrician has said that she is overweight. What do we do?
Wow, so that's probably a common question. And, you know, one thing to do is think about making some changes to the foods that are available in your home. Are there healthy snacks? Are there enough healthy snacks that are available? Are there fruits, apples, bananas, oranges, grapes? Are there vegetables available? Baby carrots can make a good snack. Kids actually are, some kids anyway, can be less picky than you think they're going to be. And they can come home and find baby carrots just as filling as a bag of chips. And having those available for a snack may make it more likely that your kid's actually going to eat it. If they're not at home, kids aren't going to eat it. So try to think about the balance of snack foods and healthier foods that are in your house. Also, does your child drink their calories? Is there juice in your home? Is there soda in your home? That's actually a pretty easy way to limit the number of calories. Have water, non-caloric beverages, Crystal Light or something like that in your home. Sometimes people can even take a pitcher of water and flavor it a little bit. Put lemon slices in your water to give it a little bit of a taste. Again, doesn't add any calories but may add some flavor. Try also thinking about, as a family, can you get more exercise? Can you take a Sunday morning walk around the neighborhood? Or how about a family football game, you know, not just on Thanksgiving, but ways that your family can get exercise together and promote more physical activity. Maybe play Wii with your kid, or Wii Fit, or Wii Tennis, or any of the sports. You know, your Xbox can be used to be, as a family event.
And I think kids tend to want to engage more in these activities when it's something fun and their parents are involved, especially when they're younger. And it doesn't have to be a huge change. It can be small changes.
And also try not to just eliminate whole groups of food. Don't throw out all the cookies in your house, because if you get rid of all the snacks, it actually tends to make kids want them more. What you strive for is a healthy balance. And everything is about balance. And so, you know what? Cookies as a snack sometimes are fine. And baby carrots as a snack sometimes are also fine. You want to strike that balance and see whether that can move your kid to also eating in a more balanced way.
And often you may not have control over the types of foods that your child is offered outside the home. So having more healthy options available inside the home will help control some of what your child consumes.
Terrific. Thank you. Our next question is about sustaining weight loss after dieting. And our caller asks, when do I think about weight loss surgery? I've had a hard time sustaining my weight loss after I have tried many diets.
So this is a really common experience with people who are coming into our bariatric surgery programs. In general, people need to have a longer history of unsuccessful weight loss before they're considered for surgery. Oftentimes, that's at least 6 months that was supervised by a professional, like by seeing a nutritionist, before it's possible to enter a surgery program. Now, some surgery programs do, in fact, provide that nutritional guidance as part of their programs, but that's going to depend on where you're looking at receiving surgery. If you're meeting the criteria for surgery based on where your body mass index is, there's a lot of programs that have information online that can help you think about whether you might be a candidate for a surgical option. It's really important to remember, as we said before, that successful weight loss surgery requires ongoing efforts to eat in a healthy way and exercise. So the more that you can do to promote your own healthy eating and exercise before you have a surgery, the easier it's going to be after surgery to continue to make changes and maintain the changes that you've already made. And the surgeries are really just tools that won't be effective without following the diet and activity recommendations. So it's not worth pursuing something that's going to take a lot of effort and time to go through the process and to receive a surgical procedure if you're not really ready to make those changes.
Terrific. I think we have time for one more question, and that is basically, how do I get help?
So the good news is there's a lot of help out there in a variety of different forms, and you have to decide what you're ready for, how much time you can devote to it, and sort of what's going to work best for you. Everybody knows that there are structured programs out there like Weight Watchers, Jenny Craig, Nutrisystems that help give nutritional education, that give you a place to go every week to be weighed and in a group format talk about the struggles you have and what's easy for you in terms of weight loss. And any of those are good, and they even have online options now to make it more flexible. If seeing or being in a group format doesn't really sound like something you're ready to do, there are lots of apps for your smartphone that are available. MyFitnessPal is one that's very commonly used that works also as a food record tool. It asks you to keep a running count of what you've been eating and gives you feedback on how many calories you've eaten for the day and how many more calories you have available. It records your activity and gives you that sort of instant feedback about how you're doing day to day. You can also go to a nutritionist to help with nutrition education, to help with meal planning, to learn where you might be able to change your cooking style to have less of the fried foods, more grilled foods, and again, overall balance in your diet. And your primary care doctor always should be interested in helping you maintain it, helping you lose weight, and that's another resource. Well, we know about people who are successful at weight loss, as Dr. Sisco mentioned earlier, is they keep food records, keeping track of what you eat, is one way to actually being more aware of where you might be able to make changes. And also being weighed regularly by someone else appears to help people lose weight. Maybe there's something about having to show somebody else your weight or show how successful you were in the week before, or just being accountable to somebody else seems to help people lose more weight. And we're also available here at the Columbia Center for Eating Disorders. Even if you don't have an eating disorder, but you struggle with eating or you struggle with weight or you have concerns or thoughts or questions about it, we are here as a resource, and please feel free to call us. And our number here at the clinic is 646-774-8066. Again, that's 646-774-8066, and we're happy to help you figure out what you need and what treatment options might be right for you.
Well, thank you. We've reached the end of our show today, and I'd like to thank Drs. Mayer and Dr. Sisco for such an informative discussion on obesity. And thank you to all our listeners for tuning in to Blog Talk Radio. Dr. Mayer had mentioned the phone number if you want some help, and again, I'll repeat that at 646-774-8066, or you can visit us at our website, columbiaeatingdisorders.org. I just want to remind our listeners, if you've missed any of our previous Blog Talk Radio topics, which included an overview of eating disorders, treatment options, and research, they can be found on the Blog Talk Radio archive. So we thank you for listening, and have a great day.
Bye.